सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहैः। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। Good morning. So I'll share my screen and we will go through the shlokas for this week. This week we are doing chapter 9, verse 16 to 20. Aham kraturaham yajnah swadahamaham aushadham मंत्रोहमहमेवाज्यम् अहमग्निरहम् पुतम् अहम् एव क्रतुः। ऐ अलोन् एंड द रिचुअल प्रिस्क्राइब्ड बाय द श्रुति। अहम् यज्ञः। ऐ एंड द रिचुअल प्रिस्क्राइब्ड बाय द स्मृति। अहम् स्वधा। ऐ एम द फूड ऑफर्ड टू द एंसेस्टर्स। अहम् औषधम्। I am all the vegetable food and medicinal herbs of all living beings. Aham mantraha. I am the mantra or chant with which oblation is offered. Aham ajyam. I am the ghee, articles of oblation. Aham agnihi. I am the fire. Aham hutam. Sorry. Aham agnihi. I am the fire into which the offering is poured. Aham hutam. I am the action of offering, oblation. I alone am the ritual prescribed by the Sruti. I am the ritual prescribed by the Smriti. I am the food offered to the ancestors. I am the food of all living beings. I am the mantra. I am the fire. I am the ghee, oblation. I am the action of offering. Pitahamasya jagato. Sorry. I have to look into my book. This one doesn't tell me the way it is to be broken down. Just give me 10 seconds. पिताहमस्य जगतः माता धाता पितामहः वेद्यं पवित्रम् ओंकारः ऋक्सामयजुरेव च। अहं पिता। ऐ एम दि फादर। माता दि मदर। पितामहः दि ग्रैंडफादर। धाता एंड द डिस्पेंसर। अस्य जगतः ऑफ दिस यूनिवर्स। वेद्यं। I am the one to be known. Pavitram. I am the auspicious one. Omkaraha. I am the word Om. Cha eva ruk sama yajuhu. As well as the Rig Veda, Sama Veda and Yajur Veda. I am the father, the mother, the grandfather and the dispenser of this universe. I am the one to be known. I am the auspicious one. I am the word Om. As well as Rig Veda, Sama Veda and Yajur Veda. कतिर्भर्ता प्रभुः साक्षी निवासः शरणं सुहृत् प्रभवः प्रलयस्थानं निधानं बीजमव्ययम्। कतिः। ऐ एम् द गोल्। भर्ता द सस्टेनर्। प्रभुः द मास्टर्। साक्षी द विट्नेस्। निवासः द अबोर्ड्। शरणं द रिफ्यूज्। सुहृत् द वेल्विशर्। Prabhavaha, the source, pralayaha, the ground of resolution, sthanam, the support, nidhanam, the repository of all, avyayam, bijam, and the inexhaustible seed. I am the goal, the sustainer, the master, the witness, the abode, the refuge, the well-wisher, the source, the ground of resolution, the support, the repository of all, and the inexhaustible seed. तपाम यहमहम वर्षम निगृह्णाम युत्सृजामि च अमृतं चैव मृत्युश्च सदसच्चाहम् अर्जुन। अहम् तपामि, ऐ एनर्जाइज द यूनिवर्स। अहम् निगृह्णामि, ऐ ड्रॉ च उत्सृजामि एंड रिलीज वर्षम द रेनी वाटर्स च एव अमृतम्। ऐ अलोन एम द कॉज ऑफ इमोर्टैलिटी च मृत्यु एज वेल एज मोर्टैलिटी। अहम् सत्, आई एम दी मैनिफेस्ट च असत एज वेल एज दी अनमैनिफेस्ट। अर्जुना, ओ अर्जुना, आई एनर्जाइज द यूनिवर्स, आई ड्रॉ एंड रिलीज द रेनी वाटर्स। आई अलोन एम द कॉज ऑफ इमोर्टैलिटी एज वेल एज मोर्टैलिटी। आई एम द मैनिफेस्ट एज वेल एज दी अनमैनिफेस्ट, ओ अर्जुना। सो इन दिस देयर्स अ मीटर चेंज, ओके। त्रैविद्यामां सोमपाः पूतपापाः यज्ञैरिष्ट्वा स्वर्गतिं प्रार्थयन्ते, ते पुण्यमासाद्य सुरेन्द्रलोकम् अश्नन्ति दिव्यान् दिवि देवभोगान्। इष्ट्वा, हैविंग वर्शिप्ड मां यज्ञैः, थ्रू यज्ञास, त्रैविद्याः, those people who know the three Vedas, somapaha, who drink the soma juice in some yaga, putapapaha, and who are thus purified of sins, pray, prarthayante, pray for swargatim, access to the heavens, asadhya, having reached punyam surendra lokam, the sacred world of Indra, te ashnanti, they enjoy divyan devabhogan, the celestial pleasures of the gods, Divi, in the heavens. Having worshipped me through the yajnas, those people who know the three Vedas, who drink the soma juice in soma yaga, and who are purified of sins, pray for access to the heavens. Having reached the sacred world of Indra, they enjoy the celestial pleasures of the gods in the heavens. So, I think we are covering till here today, 16 to 20. And to just quickly summarize, the last week, what we learned, I felt that it was a little bit more easier for us if I quickly walk through, just the summary of the shlokas, right? So we did 11 to 20 last week. So
15.
11 says that not knowing my higher nature as a great lord of all beings, the deluded ones look down upon me who have taken a human form. And then he says, these indiscriminate ones are full of vain hopes, vain pursuits, vain knowledge. They take to rajasic and tamasic nature which deludes them. O Arjuna, having taken to sattvic nature and having known me to be the imperishable cause of all human beings, the noble souls, on the other hand, worship me with an undistracted mind. Then he says, constantly praising me, striving with a firm resolve, and surrendering to me with devotion, these ever steadfast ones worship me. And how do they worship me? Worshipping through Jnana Yajna, some others think of me. They worship me in many ways as different from themselves. So they see themselves. They see Bhagavan as different from themselves, or as identical with themselves, or as the multifarious one. So that's the say, stage setting with Bhagavan did in the last week that we covered these shlokas. And then we are continuing with 16 to 20. So I'm going to stop sharing here, and we can share what we learned in these shlokas 16 to 20.
So Rajesh, Subbu here. I found a lot of references, and reiterations of these slokas, these five slokas, from earlier chapters as well. So that was so. For example, verse 16, I think even Chinmayananda talks about the reference to Brahmarpanam. Brahmaha vid Brahmam. So he's everything. So basically, there is nothing other than God and Brahman. right? So he's the Kratha, the Vedic ritual. He's offering the sacrificial offerings. He's the food that has been given to the ancestors. He's Aushadha and Mantra, the Om, the chants, the fire, the ghee, and the action of offering. So he's everything. So that is verse number 16, which is basically a reflection of what we studied in 424, which is Brahmarpanam. Okay. When it comes to 17, it talks about one essence, which is basically that love permeates everything, okay, everywhere. And therefore, the self is, you know, reflected in all the relationships that one has in father, mother, grandfather, okay. And there is a reference of Brahman to be Om, which is also what we hear in the Upanishads, right? And Om is referred to as another Brahman, the seed from which, you know, the entire universe actually got created. And just like the five bhutas permeate everything in this world and purifies it, similarly, any contact with the Almighty, the Brahman, etc., helps in the purification activity of the mind, and therefore also known as the purifier. Okay, so anybody who is, you know, constantly thinking of him again, you know, tends to attain this chitta shuddhi of, you know, being able to purify himself. So he is the ultimate purifier. If you come to verse 18. Okay. Again, there is a lot of reference to this from in seventh chapter, where he talks about, you know, what he is, right? From 7.4 to 7.47, he talks about the lower prakriti and the higher prakriti. Okay. And there, you know, there's a lot of references which we have seen. So, for example, of course, he says some seven or eight characteristics for Brahman here. So, one being the gati. Okay, now you look at the Purusharthas, you know, Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha. Moksha liberation is the, you know, the goal that we have as part of our reason to have had this human life. Okay. The second one is, you know, when you talk about the supporter, okay, we are talking about the sustainer. There is a reference to 7.7 where he talks about the Sutratman, right? Sutra Maniye Gana Eva. Okay. So that comes in 7.7 where he talks about that he's the Sutratman. He is the Prabhu, he is the Master, he is the Lord, okay, and he's an eternal witness, right? He's the Sakshi, and he is the place in which everything is projected. So he is the abode, he is the Nivasa, and one needs to take, Sharanam and him, refuge in him for everything, and he's the eternal friend. I think this was interesting for me because, you know, finally at the end of the day, when you fathom your journey of, you know, leading to the goal, there is number of lives that you are expected to have, you know, already completed, and he's your eternal companion. He's the constant companion, and he's the sutra, suhritit. Suhrit is the friend, and of course, he is the immutable bija avyayam, that is the seed from which the entire universe has actually manifested. Okay. The other point that is being mentioned, I thought, in verse number 18 is an important aspect is about. The self is not transformed. So it is not the law of conservation of energy or matter. So there is a reference again, if you go back to 7th chapter, where he says he's neither matter nor energy. Okay. So basically what happens is the creation is coming out of the Brahman, but it doesn't mean that, you know, there is a sum total is a constant. So he is unmutable. He is imperishable. He is eternal. So that is verse number 18. Verse number 19, we are talking about, again, the characteristics in terms of him being the energizer of the universe, being able to give heat, sends forth, rain, and he's immortality, death. But I think what is important, the last one he says is he's sat and asat, which is unmanifest and manifest. So what you're actually seeing is, you know, the manifested form and the unmanifested form in the universe, the asat being the unmanifest form and the sat being the manifested form, right? That is one. And the last one talks about, again, something to do with enjoyment seekers, right? So those who wish to continue to enjoy will have enjoyment, but it will be limited in nature. So you go to the lokas, you enjoy, you come back, right? And it's a perennial cycle of birth and death. However, those who, want to aspire to, you know, break away from the cycle of birth and death will have to see him as the ultimate goal. And even again, here, if you look at verse number 19, a lot of references in 8th chapter, you know, where he's again talking about who Brahman is, like Kavin Purana, Manushas, Sithanam, Anoraniyam. So there are a lot of references there. And manifest and unmanifest again comes in 8.17 to 8.22. So to me, I thought, these four, five verses was a sum total of reiterations in various ways and forms to what has already been spoken earlier. Yeah, so that is my take. Yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So Swami P says that chapter 9 is parallel to chapter 7. So almost everything is
Even there are
very.
references to 8, no, Uday. If you see the unmanifest and manifest, and if you see Sat, Asat, and all, no, it comes, and I'll tell you which sloka it is actually from 8.17 to 22 and 8.19. Yeah, 8.17 to 22. Yeah,
Okay.
there are references.
So the 15th sloka that you showed the summary of Rajesh, that's slightly different from what is in Swami C's book, and that reminded me of what Swami P said about the different stages of bhakti, right? So the bhakti is in three stages. The first one is ekarupa, right? You have a Ichcha Daivata that you pray to, right? And then you go to the Anekarupa or Vishwarupa, right? You see God in everything, right? And that Vishwarupa stage of bhakti is what is enshrined in the Shloka 16 through 19. Okay. And the third stage is Arupa or Avyakta bhakti, right? So those are the three stages, he says. And yeah, so and then the 20th one talks about the Sakama bhakti, not the Nishkama bhakti that is actually propounded, but he starts with Sakama bhakti in shloka number 20.
Good ones. Just to couple of things, what I was noting down. If you look at Shloka 16, right, there are two words that come up there, Swaha and Swadha. Okay, and I was reading Srimad Bhagavatam sometime back. I paused it in between. Swaha is the Swaha and Swadha are both daughters of. A king called Daksha Prajapati, who was one of the world rulers. Okay, and incidentally, Daksha Prajapati's another famous daughter is Parvati, so they're all sisters. And Swaha is apparently married to fire, Agni. Okay, and so if you want to offer something to Agni, you have to go through her. That's why you say Swaha and offer something to Agni. That's the thing. And then and as you know, right now we are going through the Mahalaya Pitrupaksha time, right? Right now, Pitrupaksha time, where you had to offer to the ancestors. Then you don't say Swaha. When you offer something to the ancestors, you say Swadha. Because Swadha is the wife of the Pitrus. Okay. Again, she is also the wife, daughter of Daksha Prajapati. And so if you want to offer anything to your Pitrus, the ancestors, you
You
don't say
guess what
Swaha,
up?
but you say Swadha and you offer it.
Swadha.
So that's an interesting
Nice.
thing that I learned, which is
Nice one,
very.
nice.
Yeah, but Rajesh, there's no Swaha in this 16th one. Did you see Swaha in that this thing in that shloka? There is Swadha, but there is no Swaha there. He talks about all the oblations, but there's no Swaha. I was just curious if you saw
So
that.
when you look at the explanation, he does not talk about that, but Vedic, like, if you look at the just the first paragraph in the explanation where he talks about, right, ritualistic actions constitute worship. At the time of Mahabharata, divine worship was always undertaken Vedic ritualism by ritualistic adoration of the deity prescribed in the Smriti. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so when you use your Veda-based adoration, like when you do fire sacrifice anything, you will never say Swaha if you're offering it to Bhagavan. Okay, but if you're offering it to Pitrus, you'll say Swadha.
Oh, yeah. You will say Swaha when you're offering to
Fire,
gods.
to the fire.
to the fire, but it is meant for the gods, isn't it? When you're
It's
offering
meant for the gods.
Gods, yeah. Okay. And one more such revelation, there's a word called Suhrit in the 18th verse. While it is generally translated as friend, right? I believe in one of the earlier verses, there is a subtle difference between Mitra and Suhrit. Right? Mitra is friend in general, that is somebody you know, but Suhrit is a well-wisher who, even if he doesn't know you, he helps. Right? If you help somebody even without knowing them, then that person is called as Suhrit. So there's a slight difference between friend and Suhrit is what Swami P mentioned.
No, interesting nice. What you say that. Last night, I chanced upon this movie, which I watched quite interestingly. It's called Oh My God 3. Oh My God, the latest Akshay Kumar movie. Have you seen it? You should watch it. It's a little offbeat, not like the first ones, second ones, but this is good. And it deals with a very interesting topic, and I would let you guys discover that. But actually, in that he depicts that the concept of Suhrut very, very well in that actually, where the quote unquote the devotee is going through some circumstances, and Bhagavan already knows that this guy is going to struggle, and he creates the of course it's a movie, right? He creates the environment to help him go through the. The trouble that he's likely to go through. You should watch it. It's a pretty interesting one.
So Swami P also says that all these 16 through 19, right, where he says, I'm this, I'm everything, right? This is a precursor or a trailer to the Vishwarupa darshan that he gives in Chapter 11, is it, Rajesh, or chapter 13? Forgot. But yeah, he says this is the precursor to the Vishwarupa Darshanam that comes later.
11.
11. And in these few shlokas, there are two references to Vedas, and in both those references, they talk about three Vedas and not the four Vedas.
Yeah. There is a mention of that in another book which I read. Apparently, why only three is mentioned is they are considered to be high on orthodoxy compared to Atharva Veda. That is the explanation which I read, but I can give you the reference, but that's what is written in one of the books. That Swami Chidbhavananda actually writes that.
Yeah. Even Swami P says that Atharva Veda is more on the, what do you call, the mundane, the daily ways of living and not specifically ritualistic in nature. That's why it's not mentioned is what he says. But you should consider even that to have been mentioned when they talk about Vedas. It's not mentioned, but you should consider it as mentioned, is what he said.
So I also want to kind of, talk about one thing which struck me when I was reading this. This is in Shloka 17, right? The page 627. And Supu, you did it say the self substratum of the entire universe is symbolized by the Vedic mantra called Omkara.
Yeah.
Okay. And you did mention saying it's called Nada Brahman, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't remember which Upanishad it is, but it's a interesting concept where
Mandukya Upanishad, no? Om. It talks about Om, right? Mandukya.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Yeah.
Shortest one. Yeah.
Correct. And the first verse is about Om and Brahman. Om is Brahman.
Correct. Yeah. So, and in that Upanishad, it actually goes down to prove that this entire quote-unquote universe that we experience today is nothing but a sound. Okay. And nothing but sounds created in some fashion or the other. And And then it also says that all these sounds can come only from a primordial sound called Om. Okay. So therefore, if you look at the cause effect analysis and do that, so all the quote unquote objects are in the universe, including our mind and everything, is part of is just but a sound. And I'm not getting into the details because it's very, very hard to explain that concept. And I'm not good at it. And second thing is, once it is all sound, then the cause of all the sounds is the primordial sound. That's why it's called primordial sound, which is Om. Therefore, everything else that we see here, everything which we see here in this universe is nothing but Om, or a modification of it. And so Om and Bhagavan are quote unquote equivalent. That's the theory and proof that the Mandukya Upanishad actually says, which is what Bhagavan is using it here. So in some sense, like, you know, Bhagavan has taken all stuff from different Upanishads, put it together so that we can possibly understand the Upanishadic secrets in this battlefield of our lives.
In fact, just to add to this, Rajesh, I was hearing to Sri M, okay, on a different note, all right? And he mentioned it in one of the lectures that, you know, Brahman is so difficult to comprehend, right? You cannot see through your eyes, you cannot feel, you cannot touch Brahman, you cannot see, you cannot hear, etc., etc. But you cannot, you know, amongst the five organs, sense organs, I mean, you cannot really feel Brahman or touch Brahman or do anything. But there is only one element by which you can connect to Brahman, and he says that is sound, right? And therefore, he also talks about Omkara to some extent, right? As a hotline to connection with Brahman.
Now, Swami P in his lectures says that so the four Vedas represent God itself, right?
Correct.
And then a condensed version of the four Vedas is the Gayatri. Okay. Further condensation of the
Gayatri. Chandasa Mata. It is, that is how you say Gayatri as Chandasa Mata, that is the mother of all the Vedas.
Right. And he says further condensation is those three syllables in Gayatri, Pur, Bhuva, this thing, right? Those three syllables. What is the third one, Rajesh? Bhur?
It's actually five-faced. Om, Bhur, Bhuva, Suvaha, Tatsavitar Varenyam, Bhargo Devasirimi, Diyo Yano Prachodhyat. It's five parts.
No, I think the three syllables, the first three syllables.
No, it's A, U, and M.
That is for Om, yeah. Akara, Om. Ukara, Makara. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he says, Om is the further condensation of the Vedas. And the three letters, A, U, and Am, represent the three Vedas. And A and U combined is pronounced as O. So therefore, Om is the ultimate condensation. And Lord says that he is that Om as well. So that's how he summarized this.
So actually, when they chant Om, no, they, so it is actually A, U, and M, right? Akara, Ukara, Makara. Okay. So when you say Akara, Akara represents Brahma. Ukara is like, you know, Vishnu, and Makara is Shiva. It is actually creation, sustenance, and dissolution. This Om. Okay. And combined together is the word Om. And when you actually chant, also what happens is, when you start chanting, the first is an R sound. You actually come from the, you know, depth of the, you know, throat, etc. It says R, which is the Brahma part. Then when you start closing your mouth, right, that R turns to U. Okay? And when you completely shut your mouth, that it becomes M. So when you chant Om, so you normally what they do is they chant it with that full sound of R and slowly bring the mouth, you know, to close. And as you bring the mouth closer, I mean, to close, it will become U. And when it is completely shut, it is becoming Om. So that's how Om is also chanted.
Just to add to that, Subhu, they say, which means that anything you can actually say, right? Anything, any object that you can identify with words, you have to use A, O, M. The combination of that, which means the objective, you know,
expanse.
Yeah, yeah, everything that is there, right? Yeah. So yes. That's the other one. And obviously the third meaning is the waking state, dream state, and the deep sleep state. That's from the Mandukya. So there are various. In all of those, Om Si. Yeah, but here's one thing, right? Here's a question. Because when you say A-U-M represents the three states, it is that if Om represents Brahman, it is the underlying thing that's there in all of that, right? And that's how we need to think of it rather than what is in all these three states, right? Because that would be the objective universe. And this is but from the objective universe, right?
Yeah, so I would think so, yeah.
The underlying factor behind.
Yeah. So substratum. Yeah.
Substratum.
Encompassed in, yeah. Gunz want to say something?
Yeah, Gunz raised his hands, I think. Gunz, you're muted.
Maybe come back.
Hey, sorry. Kishore said exactly what I was going to say, so I lowered my hand.
Cool.
There is one sentence in Mandukya which says Prapancho Pasamam, right? And that is basically, it says all this, the destruction of the prapancham, meaning whatever is the substratum, the A-U and M, like you said, creation, living, sustenance, destruction, all of that is all a mere, and there's this derivation, like Gunpak was saying, of everything being form and content. Namarupa, and it all arises from that sound, and then the substratum is flowing through that sound anyway, the waking, dreaming, deep sleep states. So it doesn't really matter, and Mandukya says Prapancho Pasamam. That's basically what I was going to say.
So,
one other word
which I which caught my attention in this, which I wanted to kind of mention here, is in Shloka 17, right? The word called Dhata. Dhata is the sustainer. And I was doing some sort of study there, and Dhata, Dharti, which is the Hindi word for earth, is all coming from the same root. Okay. Dhatru root, and Dharti means the one that supports. That's what it means. So the earth is the one that supports, actually.
Hey, sorry, I just wanted to add one thing which I missed saying. Just going back to the same thing, right? Prapancho Pasamam. So the substratum actually refers to the substratum of the waking, dreaming, deep sleep states, which also means that what is it that is through the all these states, flowing through these states? And Swamiji says that in the book also. I think it's for 918 or one of them. That is actually the self, which is also Brahman. So that is why Mandukya is considered, I mean, there is obviously debate about what Prapancho Pasamam really means, but just setting that aside, that's why it's supposed to condense the entire teachings kind of thing. The self and the Brahman, all of those things are the same thing. It's just referring to the same thing. Yeah, just wanted to add that.
So this word, Subhu, when you mentioned about the in the shloka 19, right? Existence and non-existence, manifest and non-manifest.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I sort of understood that manifest is what we see in this universe. And unmanifest, I did not quite clearly understand what you meant when you said that. But the way that I thought about it is like what this book has written here, right? The manifest is what we see in this universe, and the unmanifest is the thoughts and words, thoughts in our minds. Okay. And so the entity, the principle, Brahman is beyond what is manifest and unmanifest. So, because what is manifested is not necessarily Sat. It's not Sat, actually.
See, I understood unmanifest as the real God, which is, you know, which is the ultimate goal. Unmanifest as the Brahman, which is the ultimate goal. That's how I viewed it. I'm just trying to pick my notes. I don't know where I kept it. No, it's fell off some. So it also refers to the Sat and the Asat part, which is the unmanifest and the, you know, manifest part in the universe. The manifested past in the universe of all cosmos, human beings, animals, everything all put together. The unmanifest part is the, you know, eternal part, is the understanding I have. Even I had a doubt when I was reading Chinmayananda, because it was not fully in sync, because he was talking about thoughts and words, right? Am I right? Is that the question? Yeah. So
thoughts and objects, he talks about.
Oh, yeah. Thoughts and objects, yeah. What happened to the notes? Yeah?
No, because manifest and unmanifest thoughts and objects is easier to understand, but calling them as Sat and Asat is not correct. That's what I'm mm-hmm. saying. Okay. What I'm saying is,
the same explanation, he says that it is a simpler significance of the phrase, right?
Yeah.
The beginning of that paragraph, he says this is the simpler significance of the phrase, but the real or the subtler significance is about non-existence, which is a little difficult to comprehend. Unmanifest equals non-existence.
It no, says non-being. Not... Yeah, yeah. I've read that. In Chidbhyananda, he says unmanifested is a non-being, but non-being is not nihility, is what he says.
Yeah.
And he also goes to say that the unmanifested state is the imperishable ultimate goal, okay? Which is the, you know, the Brahman is what I understood from that reading. So maybe there are some different explanations here. I don't know. I'm not very sure on this. But the manifested okay. state is very clear, which is the Lord is the being of the cosmos, you know, which is the what is projected, right? That is a manifested part. That part is clear. Unmanifested, I also had the similar doubt when I read these two different versions.
Yeah, but the manifested is not Sat. That's what I'm trying to say. The manifested is Mithya. It's not even Asat, because it's you can experience it. Therefore, it is not no existence. It's not nihilism.
See, Sat and Asat, no, they have different meanings, I thought. You know, one is to say it is you know, manifest and unmanifest. The second one is cause and effect. It also means cause and effect. Sat and Asat.
No.
No?
No. I think I remember Rick had posted the very succinct definition of Sat in our group. I don't recall what he posted. Rick, if you're there, maybe you can just articulate that long back.
Hi there. well, to me, my understanding of Sat, awareness is, there's Sat. So that's Sat and Chit right there. Without limitation, you have Ananda or Anantam. So, and that's also the expression, whatever is God. But that's also manifest and unmanifest in the sense of the actual universe, not the distinction you were making, which gets back to what Subbu was saying, that there is the underlying aspect, it's just consciousness, which can be viewed as existence, which can be viewed as chit, but it's definitely all in all.
Okay.
In fact,
does that also mean truth?
The truth of yourself, yes.
Okay.
But Satchitananda, right? And because there is no second thing, it can only be a matter of perspective, if you will, because there is only consciousness.
Rick, I just want to ask you, if you were to look at manifest and unmanifest, would it be tantamount to saying Atma and Anatma? Or
I think it depends on the context. I think you're right that you said it can mean have different meanings based
meanings
on
the context. Yeah.
That's why the study is always also tied to the grammar, because it's what can be said, how it's said in this usage.
Got your new fantasy team name? Check. Real?
I've heard my guru talk about this vyakta and avyakta. That's the Sanskrit name he uses. He uses for to illustrate this concept. The way I understood his explanation is the avyakta, which is unmanifested, which is the source of everything, right? Source of all, which is Shiva also. He talks about the Shiva Shakti Aikyam, which is the Brahman. What gets manifested is the reality that one experiences, right? What we experience, the reality of that. So that's through the individual's, the soul's patterns, right? So basically that ego of the soul, basically every out, you know, the Brahman is unmanifested. It's a garbhagraha in which every possibility exists. If I am experiencing something right now, that's just one possibility of that, one manifestation of one outcome of it. As an example. So the source is Brahman is the source unmanifested, from where everything is possible and all outcomes are possible. So for example, if I am experiencing, now I am sitting here and listening to this class, I can also, there's another outcome is I can be sitting in Hawaii and experiencing this class as an example, right? Or all of us could be sitting in Hawaii and in person and attending this class. So the source is where everything is possible. And then what picks gets manifested is just more of the individual, based on the ego, what gets manifested in this reality. That's how we explain the avyakta, vyakta and avyakta. It's also the Shiva Shakti Aikyam. Unmanifested is Shiva, manifested is Shakti. And then, you know, one who understands this principle is the Shiva Shakti Aikyam. Who has experienced the Shiva Shakti Aikyam is the one who understands how this science works. Or experience, not understand, experience how the science works. That's how I heard him articulate this.
So part of what we were reading earlier, earlier verses, was even when the manifestation occurs, so let's talk about gold and chain. For the gold, there is no chain. There's only gold. From the point of view of the chain, there's also only gold. So whether we talk manifest or unmanifest, there's only Brahman. Brahman plus Maya Mithya, minus Maya Satyam, but no difference. And similarly, when we dream at night, the consciousness from which the dream and the dreamer arise is completely unaffected by what happens in the dream. So of course, Brahman is completely unaffected by the apparent manifestation or non-manifestation.
So that's what he said earlier also, right? That they are in me, but I'm not in them.
Exactly. Yeah.
And to me, that concept, you know, was very nicely articulated with the, you know, the ocean and the wave example. You know, it's really brilliant.
I like, and we discuss either one. We can discuss also as the pot and the clay, the ocean and the water. You know, when we think of clay, we don't think of pot. But when you think of pot, assuming it's a clay pot, you have to think of clay. But it's only nama rupa. For the clay, there's no creation. Swamiji used to talk about what is the weight of the pot. The pot has no weight because the pot is nama rupa only. There is no pot. There's only clay. Same with water. Be the same metaphor.
So in initial days of listening to Swamiji, you know, they would say things like everything is in me, right? Everything is in consciousness rather than the other way around, which is, I think, what you said. And I used to get really confused as how is this even possible, right? And as the practice of meditation grew, I think it became clear, right? That actually, even if you think very logically, everything is in the mind, right? In the objective universe is experienced in the mind. And and those experiences are only visible with that light that's coming from consciousness, right? And that's only possible when that consciousness is there, and to enliven that, right? To shed light on it. So without that, that hasn't happened, in other words, right? So even if those sensory inputs are coming in and it's getting materialized in the mind, forming in the mind, but without the second eye, which is that of consciousness, that doesn't exist, which means then that mind exists in consciousness, everything else exists in the mind, hence everything exists in consciousness. Right, so I think it also becomes very clear in meditation, and the concept becomes clear.
Actually, I was listening to Swami Chinmayananda last week, and you know, he explained this very nicely through a very practical example as well. You know, right? See, he gives this example of the ocean and the wave. So the way he explains it is, when the wave is formed, right, when the birth of a wave happens, is the ocean born? No, ocean is existing before, right? The wave is growing. Is the ocean growing? No, the wave is growing. Okay, then the wave reaches a high and then starts to decay. Is the ocean decaying? No, you know, and at the end of it, the wave crashes and dies. Is the ocean dying? No. Okay, but is the wave in the ocean? The answer is yes. But the ocean is in the wave? The answer is no, right? And then he says, now apply this in your practical life. How do you say that, you know, they are in me, but I am not in them, right? Now, he gives a very funny example, but he says, if you see your dog scratching, okay, the ears, would you scratch? The answer is no, right? Correct? So then he goes on to explain, let us say, for example, you are getting angry. What do you do immediately? You say, I'm getting angry. Right? You're feeling, you know, you're having a certain requirement for something. You're feeling greedy. You're feeling jealousy. You're feeling good. You're feeling bad. You're doing. The moment you start saying, I'm feeling this, the ignorance steps is stepping in. And it is actually telling you that, you know, you are actually experiencing, so you're not able to do it. But next time he says, when you are finding yourself in a position where you are getting angry, you don't operate from a system of mind and intellect, operate from the Atma. Then what would you say? You say exactly what Krishna says. They are in me, but I am not in them. Right? The anger is in me, but I am not in them. When you're doing this, you're actually changing the position from which you're viewing the thing, not from the mind and intellect and the body, but from the Atma side. Right? And it is like saying, hey, all these thoughts are coming in my mind. Okay? If I start identifying with that thought, then I am getting caught in my samsara. But if I dissociate from that thought, right, then I am actually saying that same thing what Krishna says, that they are in me, but I am not in them. And this, he says, is nothing but the process of learning to detach yourself from, you know, your thoughts and actions. So I thought that, you know, that concept was pretty practical the way he explained it. I don't know whether I came across, you know, clearly, but that same concept, if you were to put it in place, I think, you know, you would probably not get too much into that particular action or, you know, that you're actually going through, or the thoughts that are coming through.
And that's the powerful word, Sakshi.
Yeah, yeah. Rick, your hand is up.
So what is the verse? One of you will know, where Krishna says, I am all things, but no thing contains me. But it's in the Gita, there is that the sense of that verse. But the point I want to make is this. If we want to use water, there is nothing but water. All waves are nothing but water. But water cannot be limited to being just a wave. Krishna is all forms, but no form can contain consciousness. No form is apart from consciousness, but no form can contain consciousness. And even when we say neti, 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 not this, not this, again, this is where we first determine what we're not, so we can separate to discover who we are. But really, when we're saying not this, not this, we're saying I'm not limited to being only this.
I think, Rick, this is the verse that you probably are looking at. Maya tadavidam sarvam jagada vyakta murtina natsthani sarvabhutani nachaham teshwavastitaha.
Yeah.
All this universe is pervaded by me, whose form is unmanifest. All beings are in me, still I am not in them. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There is also another mention in 7:12, Rajesh. Okay. This is, of course, the one which has recently come in 9th chapter. And there's also mentioned in 7 chapter, 12th verse.
Okay, let me just find that for a second and you flash
it. No problem. That's okay.
What happened? Something happened.
No problem. But I think the concept is the same. The same principle is, it's gone to 17th.
Okay.
In fact, recently I was listening to Swami SPG talk about this example of a pot and clay. Then he kind of takes it one level below that, right? Even the clay is made of earth element, right? Then he says earth element comes from, the Panchabhuta, right? Earth is from water, right? So earth absorbs into water. Water absorbs into fire. Fire absorbs into space. And space absorbs into Atman, right? So basically, the whole thing, I think what Kishore said, it's a manifestation from me. Everything is from Atma. So basically, Atma is the source of everything. And Atma is the identity that person is carrying. And beyond that is the unmanifested, right? The Brahman existing, right? So think of it like the lens example, right? Or a TV example, right? What picture comes on the TV is the Atma, and then it gets manifested in reality. The unmanifested Brahman is the source of all possible pictures, right? That can be put on the TV. I can be a billionaire now, I can be X. All outcomes possible, even within that identity, is the source of it. So that's one way he goes beyond that, very beautifully connected the dots all the way to Atman. I just wanted to.
Sure.
Yeah, in the context of what we're discussing about real, unreal, manifest, unmanifest, right? I just want to step back to Shloka 2.16 and 2.17. The first time when Bhagwan introduces this concept, this is what it says. It says that there's no existence for the unreal. There's no non-existence for the real. The truth of both these is indeed known by the seers. But this is not the first sentence is what is most important, right? There's no existence for the unreal. There's no non-existence for the real. So, Rick used much better words like the real always exists. That's it, period, right? And so whatever that we are seeing, it's unreal, or it is, you cannot say unreal, because if you say unreal, it should not exist, but it is existing in some fashion. Therefore, it is not unreal, nor it is real, because it is obviously not real. So then what it is mithya. That is the word, that's the new word what they introduce at that point of time. And then say, then again it says, know that Atma to be imperishable one by which all this is pervaded. No one can bring about the destruction of the stages one, just as the wave dies, but the water still remains. Okay, the chain breaks, but the gold still remains. So I think these are the two shlokas which sort of communicate that concept back again, saying that, okay, whatever that we are reading in chapter 9, where it is the biggest secret. The secret is that all these exist in me, but I don't exist in them. I think this is how we should tie it back to chapter 2, if I remember right, in terms of how Bhagwan describes the concept and says that, okay, whatever is real will always exist, whether it's the beginning or the end. And if the beginning and the end, if it exists, it exists in between. Whatever is unreal, that means it has never existed before in the past, it will not exist in the future. That means in between also it should not exist. But if something is existing, then that it only means that it's an apparent existence. Yarik.
That's why enlightenment is possible, because we are never other than who we really are. So this appearance as whatever we are imagining is just that, imagination. We're never other than who we really are. And that's what makes realization imminent. And also what Subha was talking about, Kishori was also talking about, in the sense that what meditation gives you is that change of perspective, because you watch the mind reel and yet you're not reeling. And knowing that is that change all by itself. And again, I go back to, I want to make this statement. I was just listening to Rupert Spira the other day, and he was talking about two aspects of realization. And this is actually when we, in that, if anyone has watched that, it's only 8 minutes, Raj, that tape from Sarva Priyananda on Kundalini and Advaita. I really recommend that. It's a beautiful, beautiful statement. I hadn't even known that Ramakrishna did Kundalini, but apparently he did. Anyway, in that he talks about that the height of, and this is Ashtanga Yoga, is the samadhi in which there is no mind, and it's not an experience, because that is who we are. But that's the same as saying knowing I am Atma. But the second part is not in yoga, and the second part is Brahmasmi. I am everything. So important to understand I am as consciousness. But that automatically, or upon being fleshed out, will reveal that I am non-separate from everything. And Brahman is both everything, non-separate from everything, and free of everything, all simultaneously. What a setup.
So, beautifully said, Rick. Thank you.
So, Rick, you know, another way of thinking about this, as you mentioned, yoga doesn't, there is no concept of Brahman in yoga, right? It's just the Purusha, which is Atman. But one step, the first step could be that knowing that you're not the body, you're not the mind, right? And you are that consciousness. And then the second step would be, oh yeah, and that consciousness is the same everywhere, right? And there's no other. So, you know, in some ways, the way I have interpreted this could be the first step. And the second step is that Aham Brahmasmi, right? Which is then the equivalence and the non-duality side of things. So it's interesting.
Which is either bhakti or jnanam, but is the second step. And indeed, look, I don't know. For me, I couldn't get to the second step through yoga. I needed a teacher, yeah. Swamiji Dayananda, to show me that part of it.
Correct.
But the first part was pretty powerful.
yeah. No, the first step, it's like reaching the base camp, and then from there you launch into the to the summit. So you need to reach the base camp also. So the way I look at it, yeah.
Good.
Hey, yeah, I was going to say about the sat and that discussion, but this is all very connected anyway. I have been listening Shomba, those three videos, links that I posted on Swami Dayananda. So I've been listening to it. I have a long drive to the office, so whenever I get a chance. But it's extremely, the way he talks about Sat, especially the Sat part, I found it extremely insightful, because he keeps saying, you know, he goes deeper and deeper into time, and he also says why that substratum is the only thing that exists throughout everything. Like when you're awake, when you're dreaming, deep sleeping, like that is the only thing that is kind of flowing through. So why are you even thinking that this is nonsensical? Like everything is in that substratum only. Yeah. you need to actually realize that. So if you reflect on it a little bit, then you will get closer and closer to that truth. And it makes absolute sense, actually, just going on and on. So I listen to it more and more, and you get better and better understanding. But like you said, you know, getting to the summit is a different story, but it's very, very beautifully explained by him in that.
Raj, that. So yeah. Beautiful. This is the very first time I even understood Sat. I say understand, I mean, quote unquote, understood, let's put it that way. In the sense, getting close to even understanding what Sat means, because I think Swamiji explains it so beautifully. I think he talks about this. I was born, he says, right?
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
if you don't say I was born when or where, it's missing context.
What does that even mean?
So what does it even mean to say I'm born? I was born, right? So there itself, so that birth happens in time, because it's only when time is presented that birth makes sense, right? Then it's complete. Yes. So in other words, birth is in time, because time is an overarching factor there. And then he goes on to say, okay, what does present moment mean, right? And then breaks it down to millisecond, microsecond. And there, it keeps going to infinity, nothing, right?
Yeah.
In a way, it can keep going. But then what remains there is consciousness, right? And hence, time is in consciousness. And he presents...
Right.
Sat so very well. And then Sat essentially means something that exists before, something that exists now, and something that will exist, right? So that's just amazing.
Rajesh, I'd like to see us after chapter 9, perhaps, if you're open, if the group is open, to do a whole Sunday on those three talks. It's 2 hours worth of talk.
Oh, yeah.
It really is Sat Chit Ananda. It is Shabda Pramana in English. And it's amazing.
Powerful. Very, very powerful.
Let's schedule that break. I think there are a couple of things that we need to schedule after chapter 9. It's okay that we delay it slightly and go to chapter 10, because chapter 10, in my view, chapter 10 and 11 are quote unquote a little bit more easy chapters, because they're mostly adjectives for Bhagavan. So that should be easier for us to understand. I think we'll schedule this. There are a couple of things, you know, your Kundalini talk, Kishore's yoga talk, and this talk with Swami. I mean, this diversion that we'll take with Swami Dayananda's videos, we'll schedule that as well.
Well, although I'm happy to give my Kundalini talk, I truly feel if you listen to those 8 minutes, Swami Sarva Priyananda, it is all said there.
The reason why we want to listen to you is that we have the opportunity to question you and
your personal experience. And the personal experience.
Rick. Okay, fair enough. I just have nothing to add, but I understand.
Yeah. All right. So, Kishore, you said something which I thought I'll probably make sure that I understood it right. And you said that in yoga, there is no concept of Brahman. I think you meant Yoga Sutras, right? Because
the Yoga Sutras.
The word yoga in Raja Yoga,
in the Yoga
not,
Sutras. Patanjali's Yoga Sutras.
I just want to clarify that. Yeah.
But what is the other point that you were trying to
make? The other point is yoga means union with the
God.
Brahman. All the chapters in Gita are called yoga.
That is true even in Yoga Sutras, right? But then it stops at Purusha, right? In yoga philosophy, and every each one of us have our own Purusha, right? In that sense, right?
Right.
So that is okay. I get it. Got it. Yeah. Understood.
Hey, I was going to say something, coming back to like what we were just talking about, but I just blanked out. It'll come back. Go ahead.
It'll come back.
Yeah.
Even this mudra for meditation is the individual and the divine. So it is what you're saying, in a sense, both of us do, is it is throughout yoga, but it's not expressly communicated. In my opinion, again, we're talking Ashtanga yoga.
this chapter is quite heavy in terms of the understanding. Yeah, right.
Hey, yeah. Subbu, you brought me back. Okay, yeah. I remember now. So we were just talking about, Swami Dayananda's explanations. So that is actually the chapter 13 one, where he talks about field and the knower of the field. Kshetra and Kshetrajna.
Kshetrajna, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is, everything is building up to that. So if you get that, right, 9, 10, 11, like Visharupa, the whole, you know, the bhakti chapters and the build up to 13 is all set up very, very nicely. That's the thing that just came to mind.
Like a lot of mentions of Kshetra, Kshetrajna also before.
Sorry?
No, already set the context for Kshetra, Kshetrajna. It's just going to come a little bit more in advanced classes.
He's slowly building up. It's a beautiful setup. And everything comes down to the battlefield also. And it's the field and the knower. I mean, it's just unimaginably beautifully set up, right? Kurukshetra in the middle of the battlefield, and then the field and the knower. I mean, it's all kinds of connections.
So you want to think that the 700 shlokas were sort of spoken about with clarifications and justifications and everything in the middle of the battlefield is a very difficult thing to fathom, right? This would have taken a few hours or maybe a full day, but that again is the time play, right, between what is communicated to Arjuna during that time and what is, happening in the battlefield.
Yeah, there is
two different time frames.
There's no time. There's no scale.
Two different
there.
Time frames. Yeah.
Mm. Two different frames. Yeah, exactly. And
but fortunately, because Sanjaya was part of that frame, he was able to document the Gita, right?
Yes. The thing that I think is was discussed extensively is like, how long does it take to recite the 700 verses, and how long did this thing go on? And okay, 700 verses, you can count it depending on your speed and all that stuff. 45 minutes to 50 minutes ish. So did they just stand there and talk for 45 minutes, 50? No, that's not what they did. No one's going to wait that long.
And also it's this, and it's also a student teacher format, right? Clarification, justification, examples, so
Rick, you're on mute.
What the way I understand that the avatars, right? I mean, they have absolute control of the time space, right?
Correct.
And if you see Radha Krishna serial, right, the way they beautifully depict this phenomena. So Krishna will snap his finger and then accept the person who are the people, Arjuna and him, right? They are only in communication. All the others, they are like almost in a deep sleep, right? They have no idea. They just get dropped into another zone. And when he snaps back, they all will wake up to that. So for them, it's like the next second, right? I was there 1 second and then the snap happens. Then they just go into this like a zone where there's no awareness. When he snaps back, so for them that not even has happened, right? So Krishna and Arjuna are talking, they're continuing talking and they're coming back. That's how they perceive that reality. But but where is the it can be days, it can be, at that zone there's no time, right? It just is a
two different time frames.
It's not even that, it's beyond, it's a source from which the time comes, right? So it's a zone from which even the time and space comes. So he sits in that zone, he's taken to that zone.
Well said, yeah.
Also, we can look at the Gita as our own lives in the sense of the battleground of life. And we have skirmishes and we have more stronger battles, and there can even be wars. And there also on the other side can be the people we love, the people who've been our teachers, because ignorance is such that you can go back and forth on who represents what in your life. And in the midst of being worked up, And that's when you, the best opportunity to look into the truth of what's happening. Krishna sees what's happening with Arjuna, and Arjuna is humble enough to see that this is a time he has no way of resolving the apparent situation that he's in, but either do we.
I agree with you. And I think, the symbolism is also pretty powerful. If you look at it from the battlefield symbolism, on one side is quote-unquote 100 brothers of Kauravas, and the other side, five brothers of Pandavas, and they're, the army of all those peoples. And if you look at from our own perspective, you know, the number five has huge significance, right? You know, the five sense organs, five action organs, five pranas, all of them. And in some sense, you know, if these are not coordinated, if these are not working together in some fashion or the other with an ultimate goal, then it's not going to work. It's not going to work. So, you know, the hundred is probably a symbolic of the numerous quote unquote mental enemies that we end up having in our own minds in terms of procrastination or in terms of laziness and all those kinds of qualities, or even qualities of being angry and upset and jealous and all those kinds of things. So it's a battlefield within our own minds. And in the battlefield, I don't think that we have any other tools other than these quote-unquote five entities and plus this entity called the mind that we think that we is able to control these things. So it's a battlefield between these five into three combination of things that we have ability to control our own lives and our own destiny.
Nice.
Hey, Rajesh, you want to just repeat that? Five into three, I didn't quite catch that.
No, Pancha Karmendriya, Pancha Gnanendriya, Pancha Prana.
Oh, okay. Okay, got it. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, there's actually supposed to be the Sukshma Sharira, the subtle body, right? Those 5 plus 5 plus 5 plus the 4, which is all inside the head.
And Panchakosha, you are right, actually, because Panchakosha, all four of them tying together with Brahman, which is the Anandamaya Kosha, and then that's the yoga.
Yeah, so the subtle body has this these, you know, the emotional mind, intellectual mind, intellect, the emotion, and then the memory and the ego creator, ahankara, right? So you add that to the other 5 plus 5 plus 5, you get the 19, the so-called subtle body, which is not really visible or manifest as we were talking about.
No, but then you add mano, buddhi, chitta, ahankara. You add that to Brahman, all of them working together with Brahman or under the guidance of Brahman, then you got five.
You're adding those four to the last one. Yeah.
I'm saying at the end of the day, our struggles is because these sets of fives, whichever that we have, although we have, you know, mano, buddhi, chitta, ahankara, all four are there in our mind. And obviously, you know, since we are reading chapter 9, we know that Brahman is also, we are Brahman, but we are not aligned. We are not coordinated. And the problem comes because of this ahankara. And that brings me back to chapter 9, right? I noted this thing down in chapter 9, where in page 626, Swami Chinmayananda actually gives us a big slap. He says in the last paragraph, the verse insists that I am the one thing to be known. And this is the repeated assertion in all the scriptures. The self is that having known which, everything else becomes known. To know the self is to destroy the consciousness of imperfection, the existence finite, and the sorrows poignant. To live in the ego, this is what, you know, hit me pretty hard. To live in the ego as a mere embodied self is to live self-exiled from all the divine potentialities that one is heir to. Which I thought was a beautiful way of expressing the whole idea, saying that wake up, Sid, you are messed up.
You know, earlier in this chapter too, where Krishna talks about those who don't have a value for me and the life they lead. I mean, in the Gita, it's very strongly said that the purpose of life is realization. And if you don't do that, you're missing the boat. And because nobody knows what happens after, in one sense, you know, this is the chance you got. That's why he even dismisses Brahmaloka. Yeah, if you make it there, you can probably get it. But how do you know you're going to get there? What's the slip? So you better do it now. And then he also says, but it's easy. So you have to keep that in mind, I think, fairly.
Yeah.
Well said, Rick.
He keeps saying it's easy, and then he says, you surrender to me, and you know, you are Abhyasentu Kaunteya, you know, practice is what will get you there, Ananya Bhakti. So all these things. All this is difficult, complicated, but you surrender to me and I will take care. So let's see. So,
you know, that's manifested in that story, right? When in the battlefield of, I'm just switching forward a little to the quote unquote the real battlefield of Kurukshetra, which is supposed to have taken place 5,500 years back. So when under Dronacharya's command, so Drona is really, really vanquishing the Pandava armies. And then, the only way at that point of time is to stop him is by a sleight of hand in some fashion or the other. So apparently Krishna goes and asks everybody. He starts with Sahadeva, Nakula, Arjuna, and then Bhima. But he asks everybody, okay, I want you guys to tell that Ashwatthama died. Ashwatthama is Drona's son. Okay, all of them refuse. They're saying that this is a wrong thing for me to do. Okay, then when they go to Yudhishthira, Yudhishthira apparently has never lied in his life. Okay, Yudhishthira, in an instant, he says, yes, I will say it for the larger cause of Dharma. Okay, which means Yudhishthira was more aligned with Krishna to do, quote unquote, to tell a lie for the larger cause of Dharma. And just to remind all of us, right? Yudhishthira was never fighting the battle to win his kingdom. In reality, of course, he was fighting the battle to win his kingdom, but that is not his sole goal. His sole goal was there was an adharma which was committed. What is rightfully ours, we have to take it. That is the reason why he was fighting, and he was even happy with five villages, even happy with five small pieces of tracts of land. But since he was not given, he decided that he's going to wage the war. Okay. But the rest of the other four, they were not like that. They were waging the war for multiple reasons. For example, Bhima was waging the war to avenge the insult that Kunti, Draupadi had. And Arjuna was waging the war probably to show off his prowess. Okay. But it was only Yudhishthira who was aligned with what Krishna wanted to achieve. And he actually goes and says, Ashwatthama, the elephant, died. But then Krishna magically, blows his conch, and the elephant word is, not heard by Drona. And then Drona drops his arms and he drops his guard, and then he's killed and all that. It's so powerful. And at the end of the day, it's basically that alignment, the yoga between Yudhishthira, the head to Krishna, wins the battle actually for him.
Actually, this particular instance, right? Ashwatthama hataha kunjaraha. Okay. So actually Dronacharya, what I've heard is that Dronacharya actually says, I will not listen to anybody but Yudhishthira, because he's a satyavan, no? He's the guy who speaks the truth. But then what Krishna says is, he will believe you only if you say it. Okay. He'll believe it only when you say it. But you say Ashwatthama hataha loudly, and he say kunjara, you say softly. Okay. So he says, Ashwatthama hataha kunjaraha. So that kunjaraha is not heard by Drona in the war field. So apparently when this happens, and there is a saying also, there is a statement that, Yudhishthira's chariot went down a few, this one, and came down. Actually, because he was so much speaking the truth, his chariot would actually be a little away from the ground. It would actually fly, is what you would say. But when this happened, the chariot came down, So, pretty interesting stories. But again, certain things, are done in the larger interest of preserving Dharma. And that's how this also qualifies, from Krishna saying that, okay, you have to say it, you say it, because in the larger interest of this, etc.
Hey, I remember hearing this story from my grandmother back in, you know, a while back. And I was like, okay, I was actually very upset with Yudhishthira and mainly with Krishna for doing this kind of treacherous kind of stuff in the battlefield and cheating and all that. And I never could reconcile, like, how can you do this, these types of games, you know? It felt that way at the time. Because, I mean, go and fight the battle man to man and you win the battle. You need to do what you need to do there and fight. But here you're playing all these games and, you know, this Dharma thing concept was never really in the mind.
The same thing, no? To kill Duryodhana.
It wasn't fair.
Even to kill Duryodhana, when Duryodhana was going to Gandhari to, you know, for Gandhari to open her eyes and make him completely, you know, strong and, you know, powerful, etc., he asked him to wear something and go and not go, you know, without any full clothes. And that is exactly what he did in the battlefield and asked him to, you know, hit him on the thigh. Yeah.
And just an interesting contemporary look. You know, so many, I think that a lot of good people in the world choose not to fight evil because they think you are evil, you become evil if you act as evil acts. And that's why also the Gita is such an amazing illuminatory story, because Krishna is defending the good. He's doing the right. And he says, sometimes you have to fight. You have to slay evil. And I believe that. But I think a lot of people allow evil to take the higher, the precedence, or have the power, because they're afraid if they behave or respond to it in what appears similar, then they become that themselves, which is not true.
Which is the case of Bhishma, right? Bhishma, Drona, etc. They were all, you know, they were meritorious in their own ways. But when the Draupadi was being disturbed, they didn't stand up to say that this is something wrong, and they didn't stand up for Dharma, which is why they actually perished as well in the war, you know?
Perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, and it should technically rid ourselves of that kind of fear, right? Like,
correct.
Should I be standing up for this thing or not? Sorry, Uday.
I don't know. Go ahead. I was just saying, you're on time. Subbu, you want to say the closing prayer?
Yeah. Okay. So, Sahana Vatva, right? Yeah. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai. तेजस्विनावतीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहैः ओम शांति शांति शांतिः ओम सर्वे भवन्तु सुखिनः सर्वे सन्तु निरामयाः सर्वे भद्राणि पश्यन्तु मा कश्चित् दुःखवाग् भवेत् ओम शांति शांति शांतिः ओम हरि ओम तत्सत् थैंक यू
हरि ओम तत्सत् थैंक यू
Thanks a lot.
Bye. Thank you.
Quite nicely.